The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Good morning, it's Donna Marie Doherty in for Greg Hughes this Tuesday morning. It's the first week of the first show of the week, I should say, after the bank holiday weekend. Sherlock will get stuck right in with a look at the papers. But before the papers, I want to bring this story to you, which broke yesterday and we've been covering in our news. And the reason I can't tell you about it is from the papers is because it's not actually in it. And that is that the revised IS-465 standard, it has been published. Now, you'll have heard Donal on this morning's bulletin saying that we don't know an awful lot about it just yet, because it needs to be properly assessed. 100% Redress Party Deputy Charles Ward saying that they have a team looking through it and that they'll, I suppose, start making judgment on it, on how it's transpired in the next few days. I will be talking to Professor Paul Dunlop at around 10:30 today to get his views on it. A very expert opinion. Not only has his own home affected, he's been campaigning for a long time, but Professor Dunlop also is a geologist, so he's a lot of experience in this. And then I suppose found himself having to put his professional life along with his personal life because his home has been very, very badly affected by it. So we'll have a bit more on that later. In terms of the papers, we'll start with the Irish Times. I'm going to have a look here at the Donaldson case. And the headline reads, Eleanor Donaldson did nothing about claim. We have the two cases going on about historic sexual offence crimes on children. Of the accused, Geoffrey Donaldson, former DUP leader, and his wife is also on a trial of facts, meaning that she can't be found guilty, and that is down to her mental health. So a woman who has been known as Complainant A has taken to the stand, and she's saying that she came forward to Eleanor to tell her about what had been done to her by her husband, and that she had done nothing. It's the third day of evidence at the former DUP leader's sex offences trial. So this incident is said to have taken place whenever Complainant A was 13 or 14. Earlier in the trial, the jurors heard Complainant A had claimed she was woken by a light which was shown on her private parts by Geoffrey Donaldson. And yesterday, the defence barrister, Ian Turkenting, asked the complainant, whose identity is protected by law, if she recalled describing Geoffrey Donaldson to Eleanor Donaldson as a weirdo for looking at her in relation to that incident. And I suppose it really just, you know, if the complainant is saying that they were terrified and they didn't know how else to describe it. And you know, if this alleged incident took place whenever she was 13 or 14, I suppose that is, you know, how they would say it, that she was uncomfortable, that she said what he was doing was weird. So under cross-examination, Complainant A confirmed the alleged incident was discussed with Eleanor Donaldson the following day, and she said that Mrs. Donaldson was checking to see if she was telling the truth, but that she knew by the look on her face that she was telling the truth. Why would she make something like that up? That she had no motive. And once it was identified she was telling the truth, she done nothing about it. It's going to be a tough case for a lot of people to read. It'll be a tough case to be a juror in, to hear you know, details of crimes of that nature. But nonetheless, it's one that will be very, very closely followed. And of course, we'll be following it here between the show and the news. Going to the Irish Independent now. This is a story that I see, like, different variations coming up of time and time again, and it's how wheelchair users are being treated by airlines. So this one, the headline reads, "This has really disrupted my life. Aer Lingus is sued by an LA actor over damage to her motorised wheelchair." So the actress is Precious Holloway, and she had been travelling to Dublin from Los Angeles, and she suffers from lupus and seizures, and she uses a motorised wheelchair. But she says that she was left alone in distress at Dublin Airport while staff had searched for her missing wheelchair. She's in her 30s. She's been in a number of film and television roles. I don't recognise her, but they say here that she's done a lot of voice work, so you might know her voice. She sued via a California court, and it had initially closed the complaint, and she was offered just over $2,000, which equates to around €1,750, which for a motorised wheelchair, especially the way things are in America with their health insurance, you'd imagine it can go very far. So according to legal filing, the damage was around €1,000. And it remains broken. This is 8 months later. She says that she's also been unable to secure an adequate replacement, which would cost around $10,000 or €8,500. She says that she's missed out on critical medical appointments and work opportunities because her mobility isn't where it should be. And that her lawsuit is documenting a loss of income of around €9,000 as well. So Aer Lingus has valued the case in excess of $75,000 or €64,400, but it's disputing that it has any liability in it. She said that she's tried a few times to make amends, and that she also reached out saying if there was any other way that they could resolve things like helping her rent a chair in Los Angeles, and that they hardly responded to her. She said it was very callous, and she was taken aback by it because in her mind, if you do something wrong, you fix it. So there's been a long-going dispute here. She says that she was left for about 2.5 hours in the wheelchair, asked if there's any chance of her getting something to eat, and that also didn't materialise. So this has sort of been going on now. I think the legal case is ongoing. Aer Lingus did put out a statement, and it said it sincerely regretted the inconvenience that was experienced by Ms. Holloway. In this occasion, the flight was subject to an unexpected diversion resulting in delays to disembarkment outside of the airline's control. Mobility assistance was provided via airport services while the customer's own equipment was located and returned, and Aer Lingus agreed to reimburse reasonable evidence cost and expenses in line with applicable regulation and policies. And they're saying that they're trying to get it resolved with her, and because of legal proceedings, they can't speak anymore. So actually, what I should have said in that, after that long wait, the wheelchair did come back. It was making funny noises and wasn't really working. And she says that it hasn't been going right since, and she hasn't really been able to use it. We're going to go now to The Sun, and there's a little bit in here. You might have heard this, where Fianna Fáil TD Malcolm Byrne has been arrested on suspicion of drink driving last week. He represents Wicklow Wexford, and he was going towards the airport whenever he was stopped at a mandatory guard checkpoint at around 5 o'clock on Thursday morning. He failed the breathalyzer and then had to go to a Garda station and provide a urine sample, and we're waiting for the outcome of that test. He put out a statement and said he was travelling from his hotel to catch a flight for a conference abroad. In his statement, it says, "I was stopped at a mandatory Garda checkpoint in Dublin city centre, close to my hotel, and I was subsequently arrested on suspicion of drink driving. I'm cooperating fully with Garda Síochána Síochána as the matter is ongoing and wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment any further at this stage." So it will be, he did end up getting a taxi to go to the airport to catch his flight. It'll be interesting to see what comes back from that. You know, we talk very often about road safety, and especially on the bank holiday weekend, you know, the morning after, and this is what seems to have happened to Malcolm Byrne there. Now, the Irish Daily Mail, it says, "Do tell him, Pike." So this was of interest to me. I thought it's to do with theatre, but it's applicable in so many situations. A Broadway actress, after her show, told off a member of the audience because they were texting during her performance. The show is quite a heavy show. It's based on a judge. It's called Inter Alia, and the judge is ruling on sexual assault cases. I suppose regularly because she's a judge, but she has to come to terms with the fact that her son's been accused of this as well. So that's sort of the story of it. So you can imagine it's quite a difficult headspace to try and get into on stage. But somebody was texting throughout it. And after the show, so she didn't stop the show, but after the show then, she very much made it aware of, you know, we can see whenever you're on your phones, it makes it very difficult to do our job. So if you come, you know, respect that. I don't understand people who go to the cinema or people who go to the theatre and sit on their phones during it. It annoys me being in the audience. It annoys me because I do theatre, it annoys me being on the other side of it. But I also just, like, why spend the money? Especially if you're seeing something on the West End, like, that's an expensive ticket. You know, maybe they were saying that they love the show, but I don't know. And I just, I get such secondhand embarrassment as well whenever it's somebody sitting beside me. I might necessarily be with them, but they have the phone on, and because the lights are down, they're all lit up. Regardless, that's, I found that interesting. If you have any experience of that, let us know, because I'd be interested in it. Going to the Irish Daily Mirror now, there is, I'm sure you've heard this story, about the 21-year-old man who was stabbed in the city centre. I was in Dublin at the weekend doing the VHI mini marathon, and I hadn't heard anything about this as it happened, or, you know, during the day. But we were driving home, and actually my partner had said to me, because he was at Forbidden Fruits, we were both in Dublin but not together, he said that he'd saw the Garda vehicles and all the tape up, and asked if, you know, we had heard anything that had happened. But it turns out it was a 21-year-old man was stabbed to death. It seems that he was first stabbed in the arm and then was chased and was stabbed again. But there was a group there. I think a woman was also injured while as part of it, but just was in the wrong place at the wrong time, according to the Irish Daily Mirror here. So sources told the Irish Daily Mail that the victim was targeted twice, and they're calling it a horror incident, and was stabbed three times. It's understood investigators believe the first attack did not cause any injury that could have contributed to his death, and fatal wounds were inflicted after he was chased down and stabbed again. It happened. The initial attack, where he was stabbed in the arm, happened in Grafton Street, and he was pursued onto nearby Clarendon Street, where he was attacked again, and this time it was fatal. So the fatal wounds happened on his chest. The 21-year-old is originally from Lagos in Nigeria, has lived in Dundalk since he was a teenager, and is currently studying at Maynooth University. So it's very sad, but it's very scary to hear stories like that. You know, the bank holiday weekend, you're always saying be careful whenever you're out, but, you know, there's, unfortunately, there usually is a sad story that comes to pass on these bank holiday weekends. Now, I have the Irish Daily Star here. I've lost my page. Oh, here we go. This is it. I turned it around the wrong way. So this one just says in very big letters, Hornet Warning. I remember last year there was a whole big talk about the Asian hornets that had been coming to Ireland. And they're saying that it could be hit by another explosion in the number of Asian hornets due to the soaring temperatures. The experts are warning that predictions of another hot summer will boost the invasive species. Its expert Luke Nunes says, with 2026 tracking as one of the warmest years in recent records, it's likely to accelerate emergence activity. They can, the little hornets themselves can eat 11 kilograms of insects in a season. They pose a threat to honeybees. They make up a third of their diet. So, you know, that's going to obviously have ramifications for pollination and the likes. They also eat other vital pollinators such as moths, flies and butterflies and other types of bee as well. They were first sighted 10 years ago in 2016, but last year they survived the winter for the first time. So that will also be another one to watch. I feel like we'll hear lots on that. I feel like whenever people hear about hornets as well, it just, you know, can stir a bit of panic. Obviously, you think about getting stung, that hornets are meant to be quite vicious, or that's the perception anyway. But I suppose the from that little snippet anyway, it seems like the pollination may be the bigger threat here, which people might not think about. If you want to get in touch with the show, we have loads coming up. It's 086 60 25,000 on the WhatsApp or on the text, or you can give us a call on 074 91 25,000. I am joined by Professor Lisa Ryan, who's a professor in energy economics at UCD. And we're here to talk about everything that we need to know about the new dynamic electricity tariffs. Good morning, Lisa. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all good. I suppose, like many, I'm hearing dynamic electricity tariffs, and maybe I'm thinking of the dynamic pricing of concert tickets and panicking that we're going to be paying an arm and a leg for electricity.
Yeah, it's true that I think the dynamic ticketing the last couple of years has put a very negative vibe on the term dynamic pricing of any kind. In reality, I suppose for dynamic electricity pricing, it's a little bit different. It's been around as a concept and in operation in many countries for a long time. And I suppose the other thing to know is that it's an option. So when you're picking your electricity tariff, you have different tariffs already available. You know, we have a fixed, which is just a flat price tariff, or some people are picking a smart meter time of use tariff. And now this will be another category of tariff, which is dynamic electricity pricing. So nobody has to switch onto it. So it really depends on your own electricity use and whether it suits you or not, whether it makes sense for you.
Can you just explain what dynamic electricity tariffs are?
Okay, so I mean, if you think about electricity, so there's several markets. We only see, obviously, the retail market in terms of the retail price that we pay. But before, like, electricity is sold to us in the retail market, it's traded in the wholesale market behind. So, for example, if you're a generator, either a wind farm or you could be a gas power plant, you're buying and selling electricity, you know, on that market. The price, so the retail market, basically our retail prices in dynamic pricing, are the price that we're going to pay is in dynamic pricing is directly tied to that wholesale market, which means that so the wholesale market, the price changes every half hour. And if we sign up to dynamic pricing, it means that our price will be directly linked to whatever the price is on that market every half hour. So the wholesale market, the price changes quite a bit. If you look at, you know, the peak time, which is between 5 and 7 in the evening time in Ireland, it's generally in winter time that we have our, you know, our main peak, because that's when everybody is heating their homes, you know, cooking, turning on their lights. It's dark, it's cold. The price there will be much higher than in the middle of the night when we have an awful lot of wind in the system, but hardly anybody's using electricity, and the price in the wholesale market can drop to nearly zero. So, the idea of dynamic pricing is that, you know, it's to encourage us to adjust our use to scarcity in the market. So, for example, that peak time that I was mentioning between 5 and 7 in the evening, the problem in Ireland is that often we, you know, it's very difficult for the air grid, the system operator, to actually, you know, produce enough electricity to meet that. And that's why the price is highest. And the reason the price is high is because they usually have to turn on some gas. There isn't enough wind often at that time. So if we have a dynamic pricing, it means that the price is higher then, and probably we will choose not to use as much electricity during that peak time. But we'll try to shift our electricity use to when there's, you know, less scarcity, in other words, more wind in the system, and we get a cheaper price. So it can work out very well for people who are able to shift their loads. Yeah. Like, say, somebody who has an electric car, or they have a heat pump, or they have a lot of electricity that isn't fixed to a particular time, then they can, you know, shift their electricity use and be watching and making sure that they always get the cheapest price on the market.
That's
compared
to
somebody in a flat tariff when you can't really change your price.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to ask. Who is this going to suit? Because it's not going to suit everyone. You know, wouldn't be practical, say, for a family with young children to start trying to, you know, maybe do washing late at night, or start, you know, the you're saying there about dinner, and you're like, dinner's going to have to be at the same time every day.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, you have to consider, you know, how your own electricity use is, how much electricity you use as well. I mean, if you only have, you know, say if the heating in your home is, you know, it's not electricity, it's something else. So you're really only using electricity for cooking, lighting, maybe washing the dishwasher, that you may not have much load to shift. So, I mean, you can put it into, just Google it, even like, this is, you know, does it make sense for me to shift to a time of use or a dynamic price? And you'll get a little answer there saying, you know, that'll help you analyse how much electricity you use. I mean, obviously, the more technical way to do it would be start putting little meters to check how much electricity you're using. But, you know, I think you can tell pretty quickly if you're not. I mean, many people would already be on time of use pricing, and that's just where it's fixed. It's a bit like dynamic pricing, that you have different time prices for different times a day, but it's fixed. You know, you have a nighttime, a daytime, and then a kind of a peak time, which is the highest price again, between 5 and 7 in the evening. So some people would already be on that. And this just allows them to be even more, I suppose, you know, that they can adjust even more to those market prices.
What kind of savings could be made if this suited your household?
Well, the big one, I suppose, is if you have an electric vehicle, And this is the big one, I think, that all the electricity companies and the operators are a bit worried about, because electric vehicles take a lot to charge. If you're charging that at home, and it gives, you know, as a customer, it gives you great flexibility, but it is a lot of electricity. If everybody starts charging those with electricity, at peak times, it means that, you know, our peak is going to get even more expensive, it's going more difficult. So it's really the EVs, if they can be charged at night. However, a lot of EV customers, they already are on a tariff that gives them like free electricity in the middle of the night or free on Saturdays. So I'm not sure how much how much they will be able to save if they're already on a tariff like that. I suppose one thing to note is, like, you know, there's a lot of talk about how our charges have been going up overall, because standing charges and the cost of our grid and our infrastructure, we need to invest a lot. That's going up, and it's going to continue to go up over the next few years, because we just are playing catch up. And a lot of that infrastructure investment is very inefficient. The reason that we have to invest so much is just because of that peak time. So we have 6 gigawatts that the country uses at peak time. Most of the rest of the day, it's between 3 and 4 gigawatts. So we're investing in all this infrastructure just so we can meet that peak for 2 hours of the day. If we could even shave, you know, a little bit off that peak, as a country, we wouldn't have to invest as much. So we'll all benefit from people if we can just move our peak electricity a little bit smoother, so it's not as peaky, I suppose. It doesn't go up quite as much. So we could all benefit if people do that.
Yes. Now, what I will say, and that I get a bit, I suppose, cagey about whenever it comes to moving your electricity, is that if people start thinking, oh, we can stick a wash on or a dryer on overnight, I suppose just to just have a disclaimer there, that there, you know, is quite a risk there for a fire overnight. You know, I don't know how I would personally feel about running things like that overnight. Is that what's being recommended?
Yes, it is. I mean, I know that in the past, that, you know, people did worry about that, but now it is recommended that you put on your dishwasher overnight and washing machines overnight. Washing machines can be a little bit noisy sometimes, but they go on overnight, and you know that makes the most sense from a price perspective. The risk of fire these days, I mean, it doesn't seem to be an issue anymore. And I wonder, is that a legacy issue that happened, you know, in the past when maybe electrics were a little bit less reliable? But now it certainly is one that people would recommend, after 11 o'clock, and benefit from those cheap prices, you know. I think we can all do that.
Professor Ryan, for people who want to maybe try and maybe do their own research and find out a little bit more about this, where can they find out more?
So, excuse me. If you look online, so the Commission for the Regulation of Utilities has a page that describes what is dynamic electricity pricing. So if you Google even dynamic electricity pricing and then CRU, there, that's the independent, you know, the government regulator has some material there. But all the like Electric Ireland has one up as well, SSE. So, you know, you can look and see there what they're proposing. I would say that I think the electricity companies are going to have to up their game a little bit, in that in other countries, like most countries in Europe, have an offer of dynamic pricing, and certainly the Scandinavians have it for a long time. But they also offer people an app, you know, so if you sign up to one of these tariffs, you have an app on your phone. And, you know, so for those who are interested in tracking prices and shifting their behaviour around, they can see very easily, you know, oh, the price is going to be this tomorrow.
Yes.
And it's not clear yet. I mean, the tariff was only launched yesterday, that they had to, that companies had to offer this in Ireland. It's not really clear to me how this information is going to get out there. Are companies going to start offering an app like that as well, where you can track things?
Yeah.
Or is this, I think, Electric Ireland, maybe via an email, which is a little bit less, you know, easy to manage than if you just have it on your phone, I think.
It is, because there is going to be, I suppose, a benefit here environmentally, but for something like this to come in and for it to work, it needs to be made as smooth and as easy as possible for people to want to make that transition. Professor Ryan, thank you very much for your time this morning and for explaining that to us. We really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you. That's Professor Lisa Ryan there, and she's a professor in energy economics at UCD. Now, I'm joined on line to now by John O'Keefe. And John, just before we start chatting to you. I want to read out a comment that came in here that I think will be of interest to you. An 8% increase is huge and unjustified considering the profit of electricity companies. John, would that be something that you would agree with?
Good morning, Don Marie. Yes, I would agree with that. I was actually taken aback by the temerity of Electric Ireland when they announced an 8% increase in electricity. And that was coming on the heels of the fuel protests. And I was wondering how, as a normal, ordinary customer, could I protest against that? And I thought it out and I thought, the 8% rise is coming on Wednesday, the 1st of July. So what I'm going to do on Wednesday, the 1st of July, is switch off my electricity at 6 p.m. and switch it back on at 7 p.m. And I was hoping that some of the opposition parties in this country would go and make this a national protest, as if enough people do that, that possibly will send a message to the electricity companies that we've had enough of these knee-jerk rises. And people, for instance, coming into the winter will now face another 8% rise. And they will be choosing, some people will be choosing between heating and keeping warm. And these companies don't seem to have a social conscience. And the government is appears to be toothless when it comes to these rises. And they don't seem to have any answers. So that's basically what I was proposing and what I could do as an individual, a customer of Electric Ireland, who have 1.2 million customers.
And that seems to be the issue, John. I feel like a lot of people feel very powerless whenever it comes to their electricity increasing because there isn't an awful lot you can do about it.
Well, that's the problem. You see, all this goes back to to privatisation, and the era of privatisation is coming to an end. These companies were all privatised when we had cheap electricity, when the ESB ran it. Electric Ireland is a subsidiary of the ESB. The ESB in charge of the grid. We have another group that was set up called the CRU. The CRU, as far as I can see, and their board of management and those who run it, their main task is to put turbines out at sea and turbines all over the place. They're not. Their main task is not to regulate the electricity companies because they don't do anything about these rises. And basically, I would call on the CRU, if they are able to do something about this, to intervene and stop this ridiculous 8% increase.
John, if you don't mind me asking, what will be the increase for you? You know, if that's something that you want to share, that's obviously that's okay.
Well, if the increase for me would be approximately about an extra 27 euros for the 2 month bill.
And that's significant whenever everything else is also rising.
Yeah, well, that's basically what it would be. But the point is, come next October, will there be another 10% rise? We don't know. There's no leadership in this country. The government failed to do what they're supposed to do, is be a government and take charge of these situations. But because all these companies are privatised, it's all about shareholders' profits. At the end of the day, unless we stand up like the fuel protests and do something about it, like switching off for 1 hour on the 1st of July between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m, but in order to do that nationally, you would need the help of some opposition parties who have been found wanting in the fuel crisis up to now, and they haven't got their finger on the pulse of the people.
Okay, John, well, you have the message out here now, and we'll touch base again and see if there's any traction there on that. That's John who's wanting to have an electricity protest on the 1st of July, whenever the 8% increase comes in, by everybody switching off between 6 and 7. We have, I'll just read out this comment. You can have a think on it over the break and see what your thoughts are on it. It's in relation to what people have been wearing during the warm weather. It says, I'm no prude, but I was gobsmacked at the attire young women were nearly wearing in shops in the streets of Buncrana in the last few days during our mini heat wave. It's disrespectful to other people to walk around semi-naked in the name of whatever is trending with celebrities or online. I believe one quote-unquote young lady was in a shop wearing a thong and half a bra. For goodness sake, a wee bit of self-respect is hard to beat. Cover up your assets till you get to the beach and you can vainly prance about down there. Enough is enough. Do you agree? 086 60 25,000. I'm joined in studio by the head of sports here at Highland Radio, Oisín Kelly. Oisín, you're in to tell us about the draws that have been taking place in the GAA, and it's good news for the Northwest Counties.
Yeah, it's good news, Shirley. Donnamary, all three have been handed home ties, which is crucial at this time of the All-Ireland Championship. So Donegal have been drawn at home to Cork. Tyrone have been drawn at home to Mayo, and in the other side of the draw, the loser's draw, Derry have been drawn at home to Meath. So for the three Northwest Counties, on that side of things, yeah, it certainly has been favourable, because you would want a home draw. Donegal were obviously first out of the hat, so we knew they were going to be at home. Cork are providing the opposition. If you asked me before the draw, what would the scenarios be that you wouldn't look forward to?
Yeah,
one of those would have been an away trip to Cork. I'm sure Cork's not looking forward to a trip.
No, not
at all. The distance that's included coming up here. I suppose the other thing would have been, I wouldn't want to go to the athletic grounds at this stage of the championship to play Armagh. But listen, those are the two scenarios that a lot of people would have been thinking of trying to avoid, but it's turned out in favour of Donegal. The Cork are going to be the opposition. Now, Cork will put up a very stern test. They're a good side. They have two midfielders that are very, very good, will be rated very highly. Now, they didn't perform. They'd be disappointed with how they probably performed in the Munster final. So they did. And obviously, they came through their round one encounter as well in the All-Ireland series. So they did. So they'll they will be formidable opposition, but it's back to having the home.
That's it.
Home,
they're not going to travel the whole way from Cork to put out a poor show.
No, they're not. They're not going to do that. And they're going to have to plan it out. There's a lot more planning with an away trip that has such an extent of kilometre coverage.
When you're going
up and down. Will they fly up and down? I suppose we'll just stick to the home venue thing first of all, Donnamary, because Jarlath Burns, the Uachtaráin of the GAA, said today live on national radio and national television that Ballybuffet was ready for this game. As we know, there's been a lot of works going on in Ballybuffet over the course of the last year. Letterkenny hosted the championship encounter, which turned out to be a horrible day against Down, a game that we lost in Ulster. And he basically said Mary Coughlin, the chairperson of Donegal GAA, informed him yesterday that Ballybuffet was ready. Now, as off this moment, as we're speaking, I've been making a couple of calls on the way to the studio this morning. We've had no official word as yet from Donegal GAA about the venue and will Ballybuffet be used for this tie. But we'll go on the indications of what Jarlath Burns has told everybody this morning, that it seems to be Ballybuffet will be ready and will be hosting this tie on the weekend of the 13th and 14th, which is not this weekend, coming up the weekend after. So we wait to see what Donegal GAA say, and they confirm what Jarlath Burns said this morning. And we wait as well to see what day this game's going to be on.
It's been a very, very exciting morning.
It is. It's been all go. It's been very, very exciting, Shirley. A lot of anticipation around this draw. We now know what it is. And listen, for Donegal, I think it's a favourable enough draw. It's a good draw, particularly we're at home. And if we are going back to Ballybuffet, that's fantastic, so it is.
Sure, everybody loves Ballybuffet.
Everybody, yeah. There's several people from, what do you guys call it? The Fae. So, but as for the other rounds of the draws, Tyrone will be happy. They're at home as well. They're going to play at Hayley Park in Omagh in round 2A. Mayo, a really, really dangerous team, are going to come to play Tyrone. They've had some big ding-dong battles through the years. That rivalry is going to continue. I think Armagh will be happy enough. They don't have too far to go. They're going to go to Louth the next round of the championship. And there's a battle of all the Maroons. Mark McHugh, who's doing a stunning job with Westmeath, are in action again. And they're taking on Galway. They're going to have to go to Salthill. So they are to play Galway. That's round 2A. Now, whoever wins those games, Dunham Ree, just to remind everybody, if you win in round 2A, the next day out, you go, you will be one of the four quarterfinals from round 2A, from the winner section. You will go to the quarterfinals and you will have a week's break as well, because the quarterfinals are not being played until the last weekend in June, and that's if you won your round 2A game.
Well, there's big stakes here then.
But you can, if you do suffer defeat, you're still in with another chance, because you'll drop down into the loser section. And in that loser section from the opening round, we've got round 2B. I'm trying to make this as clear cut as possible. Some people struggle with it. The winners of round 2B, so that's going to be Derry Meath. Again, that's going to be a tight game for Derry, but Derry will have home advantage, and they will play at Celtic Park. Kildare against Kerry. Kerry, I'm sure, will be delighted they're going to Newbridge. Cavan are hosting Dublin, and Monaghan are taking on Roscommon, and probably what is one of the ties of round 2B. So if you lose in round 2B, if you any of those four fixtures, if you're the loser, you're now out of the championship. But if you won in round 2B, you go to round 3, and the winners from round 2B will meet the losers from round 2A. Okay, and that makes up round 3. So then whoever wins those games will fill the other four places in the quarterfinals. But what it means is, you're going to be, if you're in that section, you're going to be playing 3 weeks on the bounce if you're going to make a semi-final of the All-Ireland Series. So we're getting really down to the nitty-gritty now of the All-Ireland Series. But it's great, it's fantastic. We know now what way the direction is for the North West teams, and in particular Donegal. And they've got Cork coming to what seems to be Ballybuffet on the weekend of the 13th and 14th of June.
Well, great stuff then. We'll come, we'll win, we'll not play as it for 2 weeks.
That's going to be, yeah, you're going to skip then a week, and then it's going to be the last weekend in June when the All-Ireland quarterfinal series is. So if we won the next day, we're straight through to the last eight, which is what you want.
Perfect. Sounds good. Oisín, thank you very much for that. We'll take a wee break here. Okay, a look at the weather here now. Today will be mostly cloudy with scattered heavy showers in the morning, but it'll become more isolated in the afternoon and evening. Highest temperatures of 14 to 18 degrees. It's not quite the weather forecast we were reading this time last week, but look, we'll take it. It still looks pretty nice out there. I want to get to your comments. I want to start here with the electricity. There's loads to get through, but keep them coming in. The ESB is not concerned with the Irish people. They want to encourage us to do dishes and washing at night to suit them. Our government's not going to do anything, as they receive a lot of money through bills. They're not concerned with Irish people's pockets. The only thing they're interested in is corporations and big businesses and being EU lapdogs. They've said our ESB will basically go through the roof and may even end up rolling on a blackout to suit the many planned data centres. I was surprised whenever the professor had said that it seemed to be recommended to run your large appliances at night. I would be very, very, very wary of doing that. I have recently, it's nearly a year ago now that I moved out myself, and you know, we were talking about the electricity plans, and our landlord had said to us that she would not recommend people to go on the nighttime plan if they're going to run their appliances. She's maybe thinking about the property, but just in general, you know, something like that catches a light and everybody's asleep upstairs. You're not leaving yourself a lot of time for the alarm to raise and to get out safely. Most people don't remember this, but this started in 2001. Bertie Ahern and Fianna Fáil forced the ESB to increase their prices to make it possible for a competitor to come into the market. And that was before the ESB was non-profit. How many litres of diesel on average does Ireland burn a day for electricity? The wind energy and green energy is a scam. It's never been fit for purpose. Ireland has so many windmills that are supposedly generating electricity. What's going on? And I hear what you're saying, you know, that the windmills, like if you go on a long drive, you're going to see at least one set of windmills somewhere. It's because of the grids. This is my understanding of it. The grid isn't able to hold all of the electricity that is generated. So whenever it is really windy, lots of electricity is generated, but that can't necessarily be stored. And, you know, so there's loads being made, but if it's not sort of used there and then, that appears to be what the issue is. So from interviews that I've done and things that I've heard, it's the grid is where it all needs to start with. Oh, this is back on the fire. All fire experts advise people should not run washing machines, tumble dryers or dishwashers through the night while you're in bed. It's the complete opposite of what that woman advised. I was quite taken aback by that. And, you know, I remember actually it was our own Anne-Marie McDevitt, a presenter here at Highland Radio, was speaking to Greg. Maybe that was also a year ago now. And her dishwasher went on fire while she was standing beside it. She was watching the traders and was the ad break come on. She went to make a cup of tea and stuck the dishwasher on and it started smoking and she was beside it, so they got it sorted. But she said that how quickly the flames went up gave her a fright. And I just, you know, you just hate to think if you're upstairs, your children are upstairs, if there's somebody in the house who's not mobile and this happens during the night, you know, you're at a disadvantage. Looking now about the dressing and the woman saying to have a wee bit of self-respect. Yes, respect in shops now. We dress the way that other countries wouldn't put up with us coming in like that. Okay, so I think what they're saying is, you know, whenever you're going to other countries that would have more modest rules, that you would dress for them. So why aren't we doing it here for our own interest? And maybe the perception is that that's not that Ireland isn't as modest as it once was, so there's no need for it. Funny how the weather influences our mood. Within 5 days last week, it went from fuel prices and the heat or eat dilemma to climate anxiety with our 3-day heat. We've heard a few radio programmes discussing depression over the weekend when the weather broke. You do find that. I was saying there that I had done that ladies' mini marathon in Dublin at the weekend, and we got chatting to some girls up there and they were saying how different the weather made it. The race started at 12:30 and I think it was after 1 o'clock before our wave had reached the finish line, or the start line. It was actually quite funny because the race was already won before we had started it. You know, the elites go first, and they were saying though that stand and you're kind of shuffling up to the front line to get started was fine. This time around, you know, it was good crack. There was music. Everybody was in good form. They were sort of bouncing about. But was it last year or the year before? The weather wasn't good and everybody was freezing. They were miserable waiting to get started. And at the end, they had like the foil blankets for everyone because they were drenched getting over the finish line and they were soaked to the bone. So, you know, the weather does, the literature, of course it does, the good weather does give you a lift, so it does. There's a comment in here, and I'm wondering if anybody else has had this experience. So it says, "Dear the Greg Hughes Show, I wonder could you get an explanation from Donegal County Council as to why the toilet facilities recently put in place at Letterkenny Retail Park don't open until 11 a.m. My husband recently went to use the facilities at 10:30 and was informed by a nearby employee in the park that they don't open every day until 11. Unfortunately, he suffers from inflammatory bowel disease. A lot of people know that as IBS, and it was very inconvenient. In addition, there was 3 older ladies also waiting to use the bathrooms. The retail park opens at 11, so I can't understand why the toilet facilities don't, or the retail park opens at 9. And I don't know why the facilities don't open until 11. It's something that needs to be looked at urgently and reviewed to reflect the opening hours of the park." That doesn't seem to make much sense. You know, logic would, you'd think, say that if the parks open at 9, or the retail parks open at 9, the shops are open at 9, why wouldn't the toilets and the changing facilities also open at 9? You know, they were so hard fought for. We had a story running last week. They're looking now to get something similar put in place in Ashone, and a man had given, his name's just escaped me, but I think he was with the Irish Wheelchair Association, gave a presentation to Donegal County, or the Ashone MD meeting, saying, you know, he's from Donegal, lives down the country, but he goes to Derry if he's coming up because his daughter's a wheelchair user and they just don't have the facilities there. And he's like, he said, "I'd love to come home." But he doesn't want to put his daughter in that position, which is fair enough. I have a comment here on YouTube saying the Asian hornet is a notifiable invasive species. So there's a free app that can be used to report the sightings. Once we get the, we'll have a little look here during the 10 o'clock news to see if we can find what the name of that app is. Always very, it was, they say it takes a village. Phones at concerts. I was at a concert recently. I paid extra for a good seat up front. A girl in the row in front of me was texting on her phone for the full duration of the show. She had no interest whatsoever in the performance on the stage. And I just wondered why she spent so much money for a ticket just to text her friends. It was very annoying listening to the constant clicking of the keyboard. Oh, that would rag me. And only for the fact that I had friends with me, one of the two of us would have been thrown out. That would be so annoying, especially if they have the loud keyboard. Now, here's a... the whole time. No, would not like that. Phones at concerts also annoys me whenever you're standing. Now, I am 5'3 in height, which isn't terribly short, but whenever you're standing at a concert and everybody's holding their phones up, it makes it so hard to see. And especially if there's cowboy hats. I had been to Sabrina Carpenter. There was cowboy hats and phones. And she had a big set. So she did. So she was up and down levels. Found it so hard to see for the entire show. And the funny thing about it was the cowboy hats actually made a wild difference, because I had then gone to see Youngblood and it was in the same venue and I was standing in the same place, and just because there was no cowboy hats, it had made such a difference, and his stage was flat. But you do end up watching a lot of the concert on somebody else's phone, and it's frustrating. You know, it's just like that commenter said, you've paid for a ticket. Why are you sitting on your phone for the entire thing? And to add, actually, if you really do want a video of the concert that badly, you can be guaranteed if you go on TikTok now, you will find a video of the show that you're at from where you were standing, and you can save it. I've stopped using my phone at concerts because even if I wanted to record, all I'm going to be recording is the back of cowboy hats and other phones. We'll take one or two more comments here. I read about the recent Dublin stabbing. Ireland's going to end up like England. Up to 100 teenagers are stabbed in the UK every year. We have family in England, and they talk about the nightmare whenever we're over there, and they say it is absolutely it's frightening. So it is. And this last one, I was in the Old Duns, Smith Letterkenny, on Sunday, and I dropped my purse. A lady and gentleman ran after to give it to me. I'd like to thank them. Well, that can be their good deed now for the 30 days of good deeds, which you heard Lee talking about earlier. We'll have sports news and obituaries just after these. Councillor Micheál Colm McGillagh-Asbog is on line one, and he's talking about two carloads of rubbish that was found at one of his local beaches. Good morning, Councillor McGillagh-Asbog.
Good morning.
Now, you were at Bradge Beach over by the airport, and you were camping, but you found something that you weren't typically expecting to find there.
Yeah, unfortunately, over the weekend, I'm sure this is a regular enough occurrence around most coastal communities, but unfortunately, over the last couple of days, I got a call that to check out where some people had come. There were two car loads, and stayed over the night and had a fire on the beach in an area that's very vulnerable as it is, with on the marn grass and with erosion. So that would leave us quite concerned anyway. But what happened was that they lit a big fire and they decided to leave everything that they took with them behind them, even the tent. And that left a mess. And to be honest with you, I think it's very disrespectful. It's not acceptable that people think that they can come into any community, neither if they're from Cork, Kerry, Derry, or Sligo. It's just not acceptable to think that, like I said, coming to a beautiful community like ours and leaving all their scrap behind. Like I've seen in the past where people had come in a small caravan, and instead of bringing the caravan back to wherever they came from, they decided to burn it at the beach.
I have to say now, whenever I saw the post that you put up, but there was a few things that had struck me there. One was the glass bottles, they're going to break. But the fire still had a massive branch lying across it that was spilling onto the grass.
Yeah, it was. And people are absolutely furious about it. I put it up on Facebook to bring attention, and I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the local community who came along and cleaned it up. But it's not for the community to clean that up. We should respect any community or any environment that we go to or we're in. But these people decided not to, and decided to just shit all over the place and just leave it as they've not as they found it.
The taking or leaving the tent there was really a bit extreme now.
Well, yeah, like I said, it's not the first time that this has happened. Where we live, we're very lucky. It's a very, very beautiful area. It's in Brads, looking right across at the Strand. None go around the forest to this time of year. We're busy, obviously, first and foremost, ourselves as locals who walk these beaches regularly. But we have a high number of visitors coming to the area, and we have the Gael Scald here, or the Lough Derry Scholarly, who are here, and I just, I'm furious, and so is the community, the wider community, furious that people think they can just do this, that come into an area and just do as they please and then bugger off.
And you're hoping that there will be consequences here. The registration plates of the cars were taken.
Yeah, look, what do you call it? There's always consequences to it, and people are quite alert to it, especially down around that area. We have the owners of the land there for it, and I'd like to thank them, who do great work and are quite vigilant around people camping around the airport, but also the Carrick Fan Trust. And it's not acceptable that, like I said, people do this, but there are consequences, and when you get people's registrations, there is a follow-up to it.
Is camping allowed there, obviously done in a responsible way?
No, there's not. There's not. And we have, from right around the whole county, we have, and I want to make this very, very clear, 99% of those who go camping are extremely responsible, need that with a tent or a camper van. Myself and Kyle McGlynn would often go camping in his camper van, and you know, we have a very clear position, leave no trace, and we do have camper sites here around, need that be Ganlisheag or need that be Sleepy Hollows or anywhere around the area. There's plenty of places to pull in. Now, yes, do we need more? Of course we do. We had a discussion in our own council chamber lately in relation to this, I think about 2 weeks ago, that we do need more. There's far and far more people looking to come camping, but just because you come to a beautiful area doesn't mean that you have a right to camp where you want. And that doesn't always have to be right on top of the beach.
And I suppose finally, Councillor Miguel Asbug, the last thing that we'd want to do is for this to deter people from visiting the scenic parts of Donegal. Is there anywhere they can find information to visit and do it in a safe and responsible way?
Yeah, of course. Anybody that's a regular campers would know where to find it online, and they know exactly where they can and can't camp. And it's not that we want to keep anybody away from our beautiful area, but like that, you have to be respectful, and people pulling up and doing what was done over the last couple of days. And I can guarantee you that this won't be a one-off conversation. This will be a conversation that will be had over the whole summer, as we always do. Every year now, this last good number of years, so people know where they can and can't camp, and then I'd ask them to be respectful to our community when they come here.
Okay, guys, Councillor Micheál Colum Miguel Asbug, an independent there, thank you very much for that. Okay, it is just after 10:15 on a Tuesday, and that means that it is time for the Community Garda information. I'm joined in studio by Garda Jared McNamee of Letterkenny Garda Station. Good morning.
Good morning, Donna Marie.
How are we doing? No problem at all. So look, we'll jump right in and we'll start. We're just off the bank holiday weekend, which is always a very busy time for yourselves. We'll start, sure, with the public order incident, and that was up in Dunloe.
Yes, Donna Marie. Garda, you're appealing for information in relation to a public order incident that occurred outside a licensed premises at Main Street, Dunloe, between approximately 00:35 a.m. and 00:45 a.m. on Saturday the 30th of May. It is believed that an incident occurred between a large group of people at that location between those times. One man was transported from the area by ambulance to receive medical treatment for non-life-threatening injuries following the incident. We appeal to anyone who was present and who may have relevant information to pass it on to Gardaí. We appeal to anyone who may have travelled in the area of Main Street Dunloe that morning with dashcam between 00:45 a.m. and 1 a.m. to make the footage available to us. Gardaí in Ballyshannon can be contacted on 071-985-8530.
And then moving on there now to the next incident is in Glencarra, the Letterkenny area. That happened the day before.
Yes, Gardaí are investigating an incident of criminal damage that occurred in the car park at Glencarra Shopping Centre in Letterkenny On Friday the 29th of May at approximately 9 p.m, a man is alleged to have approached a taxi and kicked the driver's door a couple of times before punching the driver's window. Damage was caused to the door as a result. The man in question then got into a van and drove away. We appeal to anyone who may have witnessed the incident to get in touch with Gardaí in Letterkenny on 074-9167-100. If anyone was in the area at that time with dash cam footage, we asked them to make the footage available to Gardaí.
And is it going to be a recurring theme? I suppose, no, Greg always mentions this, that with the dash cam footage, people don't have to isolate the incident themselves. They can just hand that in.
They can just hand that in to the station and Gardaí can look after
look
that
after
for them.
That for them. Yeah. No problem. The next, staying in Letterkenny now for the 31st of May.
Yes, we are appealing for information in connection with an incident of criminal damage that occurred in the area of Creedmoor Avenue, Creesmith, Letterkenny, overnight between Sunday the 31st of May and Monday the 1st of June. A car was parked at a house in that area from approximately 10 p.m. on the Sunday night, and at approximately 1 p.m. the following day, the owner noticed that it had been damaged. The driver's side window had been smashed overnight while it had been parked in the driveway. We appeal to anyone who may have witnessed any type of suspicious activity in that area between those times, or who may have any type of relevant information, to get in contact with Gardaí and Letterkenny on 074-9167-100.
And that being in that type of area, there might have been, somebody might have noticed something, and any wee thing will help. Going to Kelly Beggs now.
Yes, Donna. Gardaí are seeking witnesses in connection with an alleged assault that occurred in the area of New Row, Kelly Beggs, on Friday the 29th of May between 7 p.m. and 8 p.m. A man reported that he was assaulted by two other men at that location between those times. He did not sustain any life-threatening injuries as a result. We appeal to anyone who may have travelled in that area or within the general area of Killybegs Town with a dash cam between those times to make the footage available to Gardaí. If anyone witnessed the incident, we ask them to get in touch with Gardaí in Ballyshannon on 071-985-8530. And just a reminder to everyone that the Garda Confidential line may be contacted on 1800 666 111 with any relevant information to today's appeals.
And that is important. You know, people sometimes don't want to be the person to make the call or to feel like that they're, you know, telling nearly, like, you know.
Yeah, it's understandable. And as I say, that confidential line is totally confidential.
So that's sort of the appeal side of things finished. But there's a security or financial security event coming up.
Yes, a free community event focused on financial safety will be held at the Radisson Hotel in Letterkenny on Thursday the 4th of June between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m. Guest speakers will discuss fraud prevention, budgeting and financial emergencies. Details of local support services will be provided. A member of Angarda Síochána will be available at the event to answer questions and to provide advice. Everyone is welcome to attend. Refreshments will be served and you can register on the day at the event.
And, you know, those events, they're important. It's so easy. The scams and frauds are becoming more and more sophisticated. You know, it's the days of getting the dodgy texts, it's nearly got, like, it's not quite like that anymore.
Yes, Grania, and as I say, there's just that much out there now, and I'd appeal to as many people to attend these sessions. They're very beneficial.
There'll be something for everyone in it.
There will be.
We have the Donegal Garda Youth Awards coming up.
Yes, the annual Donegal Garda Youth Awards celebrate outstanding young people between the ages of 13 and 21 years from throughout Donegal. And Garda Síochána in Donegal, in conjunction with Supermax and the Abbey Hotel Donegal Town, recognise that a lot of good work has been done by young people in every community in Donegal. We are asking the public to get their thinking caps on and to submit a nomination form for a young person or a group of young people that they know who deserve recognition for the good work that they do within their community. Maybe they know a young person who has overcome difficult circumstances in their personal life, or a group of young people who do or have done kind acts for others. There are so many fantastic young people out there who are involved in fundraising efforts for charities and doing many other amazing things within their communities. Whatever the reason for the nomination, we want to hear it. The nomination forms may be obtained from any Garda station. A copy of the form may be also downloaded from the Garda website at www.garda.ie. The application form is also available in Irish upon request, and please submit the completed forms via email to dg.gardayouthawards@garda.ie or by post addressed to Garda Grainne Doherty at Letterkenny Garda Station. Or you may alternatively drop your completed form in person to Letterkenny Garda Station. The nominations must be received by 12 p.m. on Tuesday the 7th of July to be considered. And an events ward will be taking place later this year in Donegal Town.
You know what, young people, I find they get a wild, hard time sometimes. You know, they don't, you know, it's important to recognise them whenever good things do happen.
Absolutely, it's great. There's so many great young people out there, and it's great to see them being rewarded for the great work that they're done. The good work doesn't go unnoticed.
Exactly, and nor should it. I said at the start there, you've had the bank holiday weekend, always a very busy time for yourselves. How did you get on in terms of the road policing?
Yes, so a roads policing operation took place throughout the June bank holiday weekend from Thursday the 28th of May until today, Tuesday the 2nd of June. Throughout this weekend, roads policing operation, Gardaí were conducting statutory, mandatory and toxicant testing and regular high visibility checkpoints. 9 drivers were arrested in Donegal since the operation commenced on Thursday on suspicion of driving while under the influence. 4 arrests were made for drink driving and 5 for drug driving. 12 vehicles were detained for a range of reasons such as no insurance, no NCT and no tax. Most of the vehicles seized were uninsured. Fixed charge penalty notices were issued over the course of the weekend for a range of traffic related offences, for example, holding mobile phone while driving and speeding. It was a busy weekend across the county, off the roads as well. There were 15 public order related arrests, 2 assault related arrests, 4 theft related arrests, 1 burglary related arrest and 2 domestic related arrests, and other various reasons for arrest also. The roads policing operation ends today, but we continue to urge users to be mindful and take extra caution around vulnerable road users, in particular pedestrians and cyclists. Motorists are reminded to always drive within the speed limit, always wear a seatbelt and never use a mobile phone when driving. Keep distractions out of the vehicle and give your full attention to the road. Never drive while under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Walking home or cycling under the influence of alcohol or drugs can also put you and other road users at risk. Cyclists and pedestrians should always stay visible and remain aware of their surroundings at all times.
Yeah, a lot of the times they say that the onus, or it might feel like that the onus is with the people behind the wheel, but if you're a pedestrian and you're walking maybe not so quite straight, you know, you're also a road user.
Yes, everybody's responsibility to ensure their own safety on the road.
And then finally, the upcoming Garda recruitment. We were just speaking beforehand there. I haven't seen you since that you had just come on to the job, and the first time you were up here was to talk about the recruitment.
Yes, that's correct. It was back in September. So again, the Garda recruitment campaign is ongoing, and Gardaí will hold a Garda recruitment information event at Milford Garda Station this evening, Tuesday the 2nd of June, between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. Gardaí will also hold a Garda recruitment information event at Donegal Town Garda Station this evening, Tuesday the 2nd of June, between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. Should you wish to discuss the current Garda recruitment campaign in Irish, there will be a fluent Garda member at this event to assist. Everyone is welcome to assist or to attend at these events. The closing date for the submission of applications is very quickly approaching, tomorrow the 3rd of June. So if you're still undecided about applying, please do come along to either of these 2 planned events this evening to find out more about the training process and about the career within an Garda Síochána Conor. And you can also apply at www.publicjobs.ie.
Anybody who's maybe on the fence about it, what would you say to them now that you've been in the job a while?
Been on the fence about it, I think that you need to bite the bullet and go for it. It's an amazing experience throughout all the training in Templemore. You meet lots of new friends. The relationships that you build down there, people say that they've never made friends like it before, and that really is true, and I didn't realise that until I entered the gates of Templemore. Being out and part of your community and the police work that we do to keep everybody safe, and I think that's a credit to anybody that's out there that's in that position to do so.
And I always think as well, with things like this here, you can always apply and then decide if you don't want to go through with it, you can withdraw.
You can withdraw at any stage, but to anybody that is on the fence, I wouldn't withdraw. I would enter the gates of Templemore and give it time whenever you're there. And then whenever you're actually in your training, you can decide where you can see if it's for you or it isn't. You know.
Perfect. That's Garda Jared McNamee. You can breathe now.
Thank you.
It was all good. All good. Perfect. We'll have all of those appeals up on our website, and you'll be able to watch this back as well on our YouTube, and we'll have it up online on highlandradio.com. Jared, thank you.
Thank you.
Don't be surprised if Bell Buffet isn't used as the pitch. It's not had long enough to knit, and it could spell a disaster. In terms of energy costs, the electricity grid cannot store the amount of energy being generated. That's why are we destroying the countryside, erecting more wind turbines? It doesn't make any sense to me. It's like pouring fuel into your car, even though the tank's already overflowing. That's a very good analogy for it. Now, at the very top of the show, I had flagged up that the IS 465 standard has been published, that we weren't entirely sure what this has means, but I'm joined now by Professor Paul Dunlap, the lead scientist who led the change of the science for the standard and a homeowner affected as well. Good morning, Paul. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So you've had a look at the new standard, but I suppose just before we get into the changes. What was the issue with the old standard?
So the old standard, very quickly, when people started joining the scheme and test results were coming back, clearly identified that there were minerals other than mica that we know cause concrete to fall apart and crack and crumble. But they were being ignored by the government and the NSEI on this old standard, IS 465. So, I mean, that was flagged very early on by engineers like Ambrose McCluskey, who had concerns about that. I also started to have concerns about it when I got my own report back from my engineer that highlighted that I had it in my home. So that started me on a research journey to try and find out what these minerals do in concrete. So it became fairly clear quickly that the standard was probably wrong. And testing the wrong thing and giving remediation options also for the wrong thing.
In terms of that, so this, people will often talk about, I suppose, the quote unquote, the mica test and getting your house tested for mica. And it's that phraseology came from this national standard.
That's right. Well, it probably came before that because there was an expert panel report that investigated using a desktop methodology to try and find out what was going on with homes in Donegal. And there were other engineers involved in that as well too, who were flagging that mica was probably the issue. So the analysis that was done was probably using a thing called X-ray diffraction, was identifying there were large quantities of muscovite mica in these defective concrete blocks. But that type of analysis isn't good enough to identify the types of sulfides that were in that. So it ended up being misidentified as a problem. It ended up in an expert panel report going to government, and then it was identified that mica was the likely cause of Donegal issue. And that also coincided around the time when we had these two big freezing events in 2010-2011. So they made this sort of connection that, you know, mica absorbs water, which it doesn't really. I can talk about what mica does later on if you like, but they came up with this hypothesis that basically mica was absorbing water, that water was freezing during cold temperatures, and this was likely to be a freeze-thaw issue. But that always remained an untested hypothesis. So anyway, that's where that has come from, but it was an incorrect diagnosis to the problem. And we now know through really good rigorous science that the actual cause in Donegal is a mineral called pyrrhotite mainly. In the south of the county, there are some houses that are impacted by framboidal pyrite, but framboidal pyrite and pyrrhotite do the exact same thing. They oxidize in the presence of moisture and oxygen. And they release sulfur, which turns to sulfuric acid. And the sulfuric acid reacts with the cement paste in the concrete and creates new minerals called sulfate minerals. And they cause the concrete to expand and eventually to fall apart. So that process is known as internal sulfate attack. And that's now recognized in the standard as the only damage mechanism, really, that's causing the damage that we see in Irish homes.
And has the word mica has been totally removed?
The word mica has not been removed because mica in Donegal has a role to play, but it's much a secondary role. So what mica does is when you make fresh concrete, you have to add in aggregates, which are crushed rock. You add in cement powder, which causes the cement to bind together and cause concrete, concrete. And you add in water to get that chemical reaction in the cement going. When you have large amounts of free mica, which is mica that's been crushed and liberated from the rock, those mica flakes attract water to the surface. It's got a large specific area. And what happens during the mixing phase is that the mix becomes too stiff. So to overcome that, the manufacturer needs to add in more water. So what we have found in Donegal is that we have cement that has got a very high cement-water ratio. So there's too much water being used. And it looks as if there's not been enough cement added in to compensate for that. Okay. So cements with their high cement water ratio are very porous. So the role that mica has played in this issue is that it's created a concrete that's like a sponge that can absorb oxygen and moisture quicker. And then there's more pathways and conduits for those to hit the pyrotite crystals and then in the concrete and cause internal sulfate attack. Mm. So mica is like it helps accelerate the process.
Yeah, it's like a bit of a catalyst. So that
important point. Sorry. Mica in itself does not cause that issue. So mica in itself in hardened concrete won't cause cracking or crumbling. So that's really important to say.
Yes. What else is in the standard that I suppose everyone's been waiting for?
First of all, I just want to clarify. So we were not a scientist. We were not part of the technical committee that wrote the standard. So we didn't write IS 465. Mm-hmm. We were external experts that were employed by Geological Survey of Ireland, and we were funded by them to do a research project to try and identify the cause of concrete failure in County Donegal. Right. So our main role was to feed science directly into the committee. They're called Technical Committee 63 or TC 63. So we fed research directly into them and we were able to show over extensive testing that internal sulfate attack was the key issue. So what we find now in the new standard that was come out yesterday is that the testing protocols now test for that issue, which is a big win, I think, for homeowners, because it means now that if your home is being tested, you're being tested for the correct damage mechanism. So they're no longer quantifying the amounts of mica in your concrete, which is a bit of a waste of time. Okay, the main focus is on, do you have a high-risk concrete type? And we know what those are. So in Donegal, the main high-risk concrete type is made of crushed rock with a type of rock called phyllite in it, because phyllite hosts the pyrotite, which causes the issue. So the analysis is looking for that. Mica is still in the standard because we know that mica causes can accelerate that process, and it's clear in the standard. So it says that specifically. So they're now identifying correctly what mica does. But the main issue is internal sulfate attack. So the big one is that the science is now being incorporated into the standard. If you've got a defective home in Donegal, it's cracking and falling apart and crumbling, you should get the correct analysis now, because it's only looking for that. And we have laboratories in the UK who are employed by the housing agency to look at this concrete, who know what they're doing. So the main lab who's doing this is Petrolab. So they are well on top of the science of what's causing the problem. So, you know, you should get a correct analysis now. The other thing about this too is that if your home is confirmed to have internal sulfate attack happening, there is no more remediation options in there. The only option in the revised standard that we can see is that it's full demolition.
And that will presumably help with the people who are waiting on appeals.
I would think that, because all those people's appeals were prior to the appeal, the engineers were sent those homeowner reports, and they overturned original engineers' decisions based on the mica content and their risk to freeze thaw. I've seen quite a lot of them, and we now know, and it's been confirmed in the new standard, that freeze thaw hypothesis is dead. So anybody who got an analysis or their decision turned over based on the percentage of mica in their home and their risk to freeze thaw, they should have their appeal completely overturned, and they should be going back to full demolition if there's pyrotite in the concrete. I know on the original standard they didn't do total sulfur testing, and total sulfur is an important test that's coming in now, because we know that these minerals released sulfur, and the total sulfur is always elevated in defective concrete. But regardless of that, you know, if there's analysis done that shows that there's pyrotite in the concrete, that it's got that high risk phyllite, it should be an easy decision from my point of view as a scientist. But I don't know how the housing agency will work at that. But I would think that But, you know, there are no any more outer leaves retaining blocks in this standard. I think I've had a look at it, and the only way that I can see that there'll be retention of block work is if, for example, they test a part of the home and the home comes back with no deleterious minerals in the concrete. That could be if they built an extension or if part of the concrete came from a different supplier. And I don't know how an engineer will deal with that. But if your home is defective, it's cracking apart, your home is now going to be tested for the correct thing. And that's a really positive and welcome thing.
It is a big thing. I say there'll be people maybe who've are on one of the options that's not a full demolition. I wonder, I'd say they'll have questions, but I know that you can't specifically answer those, but hopefully we'll have word on that shortly. The testing wait won't be as long either.
No, well, a really key thing that's in the standard, it was in the last standard too, but it wasn't applied. But we argued, and I know that the other guys who were involved in this too, like Petrolab, who made submissions as well too, I mean, it's clear that the testing is taking far too long, and it's also completely unnecessary. Like, you don't need to turn everyone's home into a science project, and that's what's happening. You know, we now know what the high-risk aggregates are around this Irish state. We know, for example, if you've got phylite and you do a total sulfur test and that total sulfur test is high, it's clear that there's iron sulfides in there releasing sulfur at elevated levels that are dangerous for concrete. You don't need to go to test suite B and do scanning electron microscopy and all of the other stuff that you need to do, which is taking far too much time. So there is off-ramps now. So the first test is test suite A. You cut the concrete block open. Is there a high-risk aggregate there that's likely to cause ISA? Is the total sulfur high? That if the answer is yes, it can go straight to a decision, and then that house can be demolished and rebuilt. Now, it depends whether the housing agency or the government dictate that despite there being an off-ramp there, that they go back and force testing again. But if they do that, it's not within the spirit of the standard how it's written, and it's also going to create a massive logjam. So it's not required. So the only examples that I can see that require further testing are when it's not clear and further testing is required, and that's good because it allows the lab then more space to test samples that do require it. Rather than, like, there's no point testing, I think, an aggregate that's high risk. Yes. With total sulfur that's high, because we know it's going to cause internal sulfate attack. So doing all the testing is unnecessary.
Absolutely. And you'd also be thinking as well that it you'd like to think that it will take the cost down a bit, you know, overall. I'm wondering, Professor, was there anything in the standard in relation to foundation tests? I know that's also been a sticking point.
Yeah, well, I mean, the original standard didn't test foundations because it just says, well, this is only to do with concrete blocks. But the new standard now has incorporated testing. Now, that wasn't an easy thing to get in because there was a bit of resistance around foundations. Now, we were given three homes that were defective to look at, and the samples that we looked at, we couldn't find internal sulfate attack happening at an advanced stage. We did find that the concrete on the defective properties had pyrotite in the samples. We found that there was a high cement water ratio. So although the concrete's better, more high density concrete than the concrete blocks, still not an amazing quality concrete. And we also found that the pyrotite was oxidizing and releasing sulfur, but we didn't see the secondary sulfate minerals, secondary ettringite, thomasite and gypsum being formed. And those are the minerals that cause the concrete to expand and fall apart.
Would it be accurate to say that it was as if it was in the earlier stages?
Yeah, at an initial stage. We found that it was an initial stage, and therefore we said, well, if you have all the ingredients in a concrete to cause internal sulfate attack, then there's a risk there, and it's long term. It seems to be, for us, it's the exposure conditions that's driving the reaction. So the more exposure concrete is, the more likely it is to fall apart. But the concrete beneath ground is buried in soil that's likely to be wet. So that probably suppresses the diffusion of gas and oxygen into the concrete. But yeah, I just want to put this in. We only looked at a small number of samples, and we can't say that that's reflective of the entire situation. But we now know there's around 20,000 homes at least minimum impacted by this. So our argument was always very clear. The NSAI, as a scientific point of view, if it's the case that the standard is now moving towards removing all the concrete blocks, i.e. demolition is the only option for an intentional sulphate attack, why would you take the risk or put all of the risk back onto the homeowner? It's better to remove the concrete foundations and just start again and create long-term sustainable homes. So that was our opinion, but we didn't write the standard. But what you do have in there now is at least now the concrete is being tested. It does say that it's not being used to test to give a risk kit. A risk, it's on to do more about testing from memory now, reading it yesterday. It's testing to see the presence of whether deleterious minerals are there or not. Mm. But there is a route for removal if it's deemed as being high risk, but that'll probably be left in the engineer's hand, and it's very open to interpretation. But I just go back to the point, you know, if there's a risk there and the ingredients are there for internal sulphate attack and the houses are definitely coming down, then why just not rip it out and start from scratch?
That was, I suppose, the thoughts of many people on the ground who just would have thought that would have made sense. Yeah.
Some homeowners might be in a position where they get a test result back where, look, you know, you don't have any deleterious minerals and your concrete foundations are actually fine. So for those homes, then, you know, that saves them as the £30,000 ripping them out unknown. So at least now, people will get some information about what's in their concrete. And at least now, if there's a high risk, it'll be gone. It'll be taken out not at their expense. And everything else is going to be probably fall on the homeowner again. But that's something for maybe the politicians to take up with NSEI about how that decision was made.
And it will also be a question, I suppose, for politicians to ask how this is going to reflect now in the scheme, because my understanding is that's not a provision in it.
Say again,
that foundations aren't covered in the scheme.
Well, they are, because the fact that they're testing them now and there's a route for removal in the mm-hmm. standard, it means that they'll have to be. So that would be my interpretation of it. I mean, you can't have a route for removal of foundations without covering that in the scheme. So, but again, this is for the local politicians to ask the question. But this now, the publication of that standard yesterday now triggers automatically a review of the entire scheme legislatively. So that's where this will be teased out. But I would have thought, you know, you can't have a route for removal of foundations and ask the homeowners to remove it.
Exactly. I just want to briefly touch, there was updates to the scheme last week as well with the introduction of side-by-side building. It's good to see the progression of the IS465 and this happening side-by-side. It's both things have been waited for a long time.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, a lot of things that should have been done a long time ago have now come to fruition as of the last couple of weeks. You know, it didn't make sense for homes that are built side-by-side not to be done together. You know, we know this concrete is expanding. So if a house is fixed and it joins on to another one that's not fixed, the house that's not fixed will continue to expand and push into the other one. So there has to be a very detailed engineering solution to stop that expansion impacting on the new home that's built. So, you know, a lot of these things could have been dealt with years ago, but it just seems to be this whole thing has been a very difficult process. You know, for example, we were talking about internal sulphate attack as far back as 2022 when we first talked about it. And we ran at the European Parliament with Luke Ming Flanagan. We identified clearly that internal sulphate attack was the issue. We then published that in Cement and Concrete Research in 2023. We went to the Oireachtas Committee and highlighted it again, but it took years to get to the position where NSEI accepted that based on the science. So, you know, I think personally, from a scientific point of view, things have moved on massively. So from my reading of the standard, homes will be tested correctly, and where things might change will be how it's interpreted in the housing agency and their engineers. But, you know, from what I can see, we know what the high-risk aggregates are. The laboratory tests know what they look for. And it should be the case that people should be getting the correct decisions now. I don't know what happens for homes that might be slightly at a situation where there's very, very low levels of total sulfur. We know some houses like that are cracking, but in the standard that we saw in March, they had set up a cutoff point of total sulfur at 0.3. That has been removed. My reading of the standard is that there's no damage threshold in the standard anymore. So you usually have to have a cracks of a millimetre and a half. So, you know, I'm hoping that things will improve from basically what's in the standard now. But, you know, like everything else with this, you know, it depends how it's interpreted now going forward. But let's hope that there's no more shenanigans. You know, the things that happened to the downgrade owners was awful. You know, we've been talking about that there is zero evidence for mica causing freeze thaw for years, and there is zero evidence for that. Yet we had engineering companies in Ireland that were being sent homeowner reports and overturning them based on that nonsense that their houses were impacted by freeze thaw and giving them out reliefs, when all of the science was pointing towards a different issue, internal sulphate attack, which is impacting the entire structure of the building.
I just want to read you this comment. It says, hats off to all the campaigners. It's taken a very long time to get here. What annoys me is the amount of politicians claiming credit for this, but nothing's achieved but power, but people, power and relentless campaigning. And Professor, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I have some comments here that we'll get to just after the break, but Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I was speaking there with Professor Paul Dunlop in relation to the new IS 465 standard for defective concrete. Donegal County Council have released a statement which I'll read. Statement by Donegal County Council on the commitments of further provisions for the DCB Amendment Act 2025. Donegal County Council acknowledges the commencements of further provisions contained in the DCB Amendment Act 2025 and the adoption of associated regulations. The newly adopted regulations, together with a guidance note and your questions answered document on these amendments, will be issued to all designated local authorities in the coming days. Once received, the council staff will have to review and familiarise themselves with the guidances. The council appreciate homeowners' continued patience and understanding as staff manage this heightened workload during the initial implementation period. Please bear that in mind in the early stages of implementing the amendments. The council will likely receive a high volume of calls and queries. Applicants are respectfully requested to review all of the relevant information on the council's website and online portal, which will be updated soon. We in the newsroom cover the defective block meetings that happen every month. And I have to say, across the board, all of the councillors always give thanks and pay tribute to the team that work in the council office trying to deal with calls and the likes of that. This information is new for everyone. They're, I suppose, what the council's saying there is that they're receiving this at the same time, and they want to make sure that they have it right in their own heads before they start, I suppose, advising people on it. They're going to have there's two documents up there, a guidance note and your questions answered. So hopefully they'll have that up on the portal and on the council website soon. And I would like to think this will have a bit of hope for people now. You know, living in your house and it falling around you, it's a terrible, terrible position that a lot of people have been forced into. So we hope that this will maybe be the start of a new era in it. There's comments in here saying a big problem in the blocks was the lack of cement. I'm watching homes all around me being sold to unsuspecting new homeowners. Is the next campaign to stop this happening? I'm not too sure. I'm not a builder. I don't have that sort of, you know, knowledge behind me. But I'm fairly certain that a lot of the houses now need to be tested to be sold. But I know that with the new standard, and how quick Paul was saying that the results will be given back now. Most people, I suppose, it's just good practice. If you are buying a house, you want to have that test done. And with this new standard, hopefully that should make things an awful lot easier. Without Professor Paul Dunlop, I'm unsure where the downgraded homeowners would be. He pushed and helped and was a fountain of knowledge. An incredibly smart man, ethically led, who scientifically proved that the downgrades were not only legally flawed, but scientifically flawed. Thank you, Professor Paul Dunlop, for everything. And that's in from Marty Micklehenny, who'd be a friend of the show. We've spoken to Marty a few times. It is. It's true. It's thanks to campaigners like Paul that this has come forward. And, you know, I do often think if it wasn't for the fact that Paul's own home was affected, you know, obviously he's in that field and would have become aware of it. But just because he said there, it was whenever he was looking at his own report, he was sort of thinking, something's not quite right here. Can you ask why my house that was built in the 70s is crumbling now, pumped it 10 years ago, and now the house is crumbling? Not too sure on that. I'd say maybe if you're worried that you're suspected that it is defective concrete, maybe a good thing to do first would be to maybe go to one of your local representatives. They might be able to start helping you out. Is the stones tested in the quarries now? My understanding is that they're not, that this standard and the testing is still for private homes. You know, we're still, I suppose, the next big awaited news now is when will we have a scheme for council houses that are affected? When will we have a scheme for businesses that are affected, for schools and the likes of that there? That's what everyone is waiting for now, because there is people living in council or social housing, and that's their next question. You know, they're in there, they're waiting for a scheme to come so that they can start getting remediation done there. That is all for the Greg Hughes Show for today. Thanks to Caroline Orr and Shannon Wilkin for producing and researching the show. John Breslin's up next on Around the Northwest.